Chapter 21. Sunday, May 8th, 0011, New Era. Eden Command. President Pauling stood with his back turned to the High Command. His arms were folded across his chest, and his stern countenance scrutinized the Eden logo on the wall monitor. Silence prevailed throughout the conference room. No whispered chatter, no council addresser, no presentation. Nothing. 11 of the 12 judges sat behind him, their quiet stares split between the president's back and the black lifelessness of the round table. No papers waited on its glossy surface. There were only the hollow reflections of the High Command. Judge Rath broke the silence as he looked from the table to the president. As he began to speak, the judges around him edged their eyes in his direction.
Sir, there was nothing anybody could have done.
I'll tell you what could and could not have been done.
Rath sighed and resumed his quiet observance.
Complacency. This organization has grown complacent, and now we see the results.
Sir, if I may.
What?
Novosibirsk was defended, sir. The attack was repelled. If anything, this is a testament to our ability to react without warning.
This is a testament to the training of the Nightmen. The attack never should have happened in the first place.
And who is to blame for that, sir? Who is to blame for inferior technology?
We're to blame for not finding a way around it.
Pauling's glare targeted Judge Iwayama, a smaller man and one of two Japanese judges on the High Command.
What's the progress of the no-boat detection system?
Iwayama stuttered through a reply.
We are still trying to...
Trying is not acceptable. We've been trying for years. We need to be doing. I refuse to believe that with all the scientists and with all the engineers we have working for this organization, we still have nothing. For 2 years you've been trying. That's not good enough!
Judge Malcolm Blake cleared his throat. The eyes of the council swiveled to face the African Englishman.
With all due respect, sir, Mamoru has had his hands full heading R&D, and he's done a superb job. Perhaps some delegation would speed up our progress.
We have more scientists than sand on a beach. How much more delegation do you want?
But only one judge to oversee it. Well, that's far too much to rest on one man's shoulders. With your permission, sir, I'll assist in the workload. I'll pick up detection and whatever else Mamoru feels I can handle. With two of us overseeing, surely things will come to speed.
Pauling eyed Blake, then diverted his attention to Iwayama.
Do you object to this?
No, sir. The extra help would be very good. Perhaps detection needs a new approach.
Pauling nodded to Blake.
You have detection and whatever else Mamoru gives you.
Thank you, sir.
Pauling addressed Iwayama without looking.
Get together with Malcolm after we close and get yourselves organized.
Yes, sir.
We're protecting a planet, people. We can't settle for anything less than perfection. It's a miracle we've arrived this far and we're barely holding on as it is.
A distinct pause fell over the room as Pauling stood before them, severe and overbearing. His features were different, hardened and aged. He allowed his gaze to slide down to the table where it lingered.
As much as I hate to bring it up again, the mourning period is over. Have you been able to locate any of Kentwood's intelligence documents?
Rath frowned and lowered his eyes.
No, sir. I even spoke with Kang. He, too, was unaware of any documents. We can only hope that whatever concerns Daryl found, we can find also.
And the investigation?
It was as natural a heart attack as anyone can have. It just came at a bad time.
I have yet to hear of one that comes at a good time. I've spoken with Archer, your suggestion as a replacement. You were right. He's an intelligent candidate. He's young, but he may have promise.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad he was a worthy recommendation.
Pauling sank into his chair and stared at the opaque table. His older reflection stared back at him. After several moments, he waved his hand in dismissal.
That's all this morning.
Nods of acknowledgement were offered to him, as the judges rose from their chairs and filtered out of the room. Their exodus was quicker than usual, and the typical cloud of post-meeting chatter was absent. It was only a matter of seconds until Pauling was alone.
"Judge Archer,"
he said to himself as he pondered the empty seat where Darrell Kentwood used to sit. His eyes remained there for a moment before he pivoted in his chair and turned his back to the conference room, losing his gaze on the Eden logo in front of the room.
"Welcome to the High Command."
Novosibirsk, Russia. It was dawn, 0446 hours Russian time, when the sun broke over Novosibirsk's horizon. The temperature was bitter cold, and a subtle breeze drifted over the freshly fallen snow. Despite the sparse cloud patches, it was a beautiful morning, at least from nature's point of view. The scope of the damage could be seen for the first time, as the overcast sky was illuminated just enough to dissipate the darkness of the night. The fires that raged only a few hours earlier were now extinguished, though the destruction was irreversible. Novosibirsk's gargantuan hangar had been destroyed. Holes camouflaged its concrete walls, and one whole corner of the building was caved in beyond recognition. Rubble was piled around the hangar. Cleanup crews hustled to make the way clear for repair vehicles. While several aircraft inside the hangar were salvageable, a majority were battered beyond repair. The airstrip was in poor condition, more from clutter than physical damage. Of the no-boats that remained, few were in proper condition to be dissected and evaluated. The combination of heavy gunfire from the Novosibirsk defenders and attack strafes by Leningrad's Air Force mangled all but a handful of the alien craft. The only other salvaged ships were the four carriers, which were taken into custody along with the captured Bakhma. The infirmary, though defended, was in no condition to remain. An on-the-spot evaluation revealed massive structural damage that rendered the building more of a hazard to the wounded than a shelter. It would have to be torn down and rebuilt, a process that Eden claimed would be more inconvenient than costly. All the recoverable medical supplies were transported to the gymnasium, which became Novosibirsk's temporary hospital. As the medical staff settled in, the full scope of the wounded came into view. Undermanned medically, crews of surgeons and nurses from Leningrad and London were called in to assist the staff on hand. Many of the damaged buildings throughout the base were also beyond repair. There were very few buildings that had survived the fight unscathed. Nonetheless, the battle was dubbed a victory. Novosibirsk, the machine, would live on. The human body count reached over 3,000, 80 of which were nightmen. Some units were leaderless, while others were decimated from one end to the other. It had been the most deadly assault against an Eden facility in the organization's history. The 14th shared in the casualties. Evan Baranov, Kevin Carpenter, and Konstantin Makarovich were dead. An equal amount were wounded. Fox's career with Eden was finished. Though the doctors were confident in his ability to return to a normal life, they were certain it would not be one with the Earth Defense Network. He was due to be shipped to a United States hospital as soon as the next series of transports arrived. The rest was up to him. Max's mishandling of his previous injuries prolonged his expected date of release. Several doctors paused by his cot to reprimand him for his foolhardy actions as they ordered him to remain bedridden until given precise permission to leave. He made no promises, nor offered apologies. Galina was stabilized soon after the battle was finished, and she was given a special location in the new hospital, set aside specifically for the injured among the medical crew. Once she was calmed and aware, she was told of Ivan's sacrifice. She met the news, expectedly, with tears. Then it was morning. Late Sunday morning, on May the 8th, in the 11th year of the new era. It was not even the morning after the battle. It was the morning of the battle. Scott remembered every hour that passed on the clock that night, if it could be called a night at all. 0400, then 0500, all the way to 0900. He knew that he slept, but it was anything but restful. It was more like periodic glimpses of the unconscious world. When true morning arrived, he found himself as exhaustingly awake as he had been in the aftermath of the attack. He was not alone. No operative in the 14th remained still beneath the woolen covers of their bunks. There was a quiet stagnation to room 14. Amid the creaking of bed springs and hourly face washings in the lounge sink, it was the empty bunks that mourned the loudest. By the time late morning came, the silence was unbearable. Scott rose from bed, donned his uniform, and ventured into the hallway. David offered him company, and Scott accepted gratefully. Together, they abandoned the emotional atmosphere of the barracks and ventured back into the outside world. For the first time in daylight, they saw the aftermath of the assault. They saw the battle-scorched airstrip and the demolished hangar. They saw the unsalvageable Vindicators and the overturned Grizzlies. They saw it all without the need to explore. The damage was in every direction. Nothing came full circle. Though Scott and David talked little, Scott knew that David's questions must have been as deep and uncertain as his own. What happened now? How would they rebuild Novosibirsk? How would they rebuild the 14th? Yet above those hung the darkest question of all. Why was Earth still alive? Baranov had said it before he died. The advantage clearly weighed in favor of the attackers. This latest attack furthered that. The Bakhma could assault Novosibirsk without a single human aware of it. The base was defended, but for how long? When would the invaders decide that enough was enough? When would they send their full force? Why hadn't they already? Scott was in the midst of those thoughts when he noticed Clark. The captain stood alongside the covered sidewalk between the barracks and the cafeteria, walking cane in his grasp as he stared at the remnants of the assault. He looked tired. His shoulders sagged like Scott hadn't seen before, and even from a distance, his anguished expression was unable to hide itself. Scott knew why. The 14th was a decimated unit, and Clark was the one it fell on. It took only a slight shift for Scott to alter his path to meet the captain, and he did for no particular reason, other than the feeling that it needed to be done. David followed in silence. As Clark took notice of the two, he hobbled his body in their direction and waited. A metal brace was attached to his hip, which was stamped with healing cloth. The smile they were met with was a false one, but the attempt was there.
How goes it, gentlemen?
Sir?
In the seconds that followed, no words were spoken. The three men exchanged glances until their gazes abandoned one another to observe the devastation around them. When Clark spoke again, it seemed as though it was for the first time.
I just got back from the gymnasium. Everyone is in stable condition, for now.
That's good to hear, sir.
Yes. Yes, it is. None of this should have happened. We're too careful to allow this to happen.
Scott canted his head down as he listened.
Changes need to be made.
Changes. That was all Scott knew. When he had joined Eden, it was a change. When he fought in Chicago, it was a change. When he was brought to Novosibirsk, that part was still changing. The thought of change didn't scare him anymore. Change was home.
What are we going to do, sir?
We rebuild. We count our losses and we evaluate where we stand. Then we rebuild.
Spoken like a captain. All compasses read forward.
Yuri shall assume the role of commander, and when Max recovers, he'll be good to resume his duties.
Clark looked between them before his eyes settled on Scott.
Which leaves us short one lieutenant.
Scott knew it was him without Clark saying a word. God had put him in the place he needed to be, and he knew there was a reason. It was destiny. All compasses read forward.
Remember everything you've learned, Remington. Remember the things I've warned you about.
Yes, sir.
There are things none of us yet understand. Look around here, and we're seeing that now. Your beginning is over. What you give now is what is to be expected.
Yes, sir.
Clark stared into the distance as Scott stood deep in thought. Everything had led to where he was now. Everything pointed to that moment. In the midst of the losses, Scott's heart mourned. But in the anticipation of the future, it was ready.
Gentlemen, more is going to be asked of you than I expected by this point. But I know you both will serve us well.
He straightened out his uniform, and when he saluted, Scott and David were crisp in their response.
Yes, sir.
Clark lowered his salute.
Cheerio, gentlemen,
he said before turning and hobbling away. Neither Scott nor David spoke as they watched the captain leave. Their gazes lingered on him for a moment, then shifted to the pristine snowfields. They were beautiful. Scott took several steps off of the sidewalk, where his feet crunched in the hardened snow.
You know he meant you, right?
Scott heard the question. He knew. In a decimated unit, people were destined to rise up. And destiny had taken him there.
Yeah,
he answered as he looked into the horizon.
I know.
The air was fresh as winter. It frosted as it escaped from his mouth and nostrils. He feigned a smile and turned around.
He meant you, too.
David watched Scott for a moment before a smile crept from his lips.
Whatever you say, sir.
Scott chuckled, and David stepped off the sidewalk to his side.
It's beautiful when you take the time to look at it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It was beautiful. The longer he stayed in Novosibirsk, the more he noticed it. He was determined to notice it more than ever. David smiled and stepped back.
Now, if you'll excuse me, there's a woman a few thousand miles away who just heard about an attack on Novosibirsk. I think she's going to want to know if her man is okay. And I don't think she's the only one.
Go make your call. I'll be right behind you.
David turned and walked toward the barracks. Scott continued to smile to himself. There was a woman a few thousand miles away who needed to hear from her man. And there was a man in the middle of Russia who needed her just as much. Scott's gaze returned to the snowfields. They were indeed so beautiful, as if they were God's own artwork. He stepped back and returned to the sidewalk that led to the barracks. There was a very important phone call that he needed to make, and he could not wait any longer. Inside, he had never felt so warm.
We'll be right back. This has been Epic, Book 1, Dawn of Destiny, written by Lee Steven, narrated by Patrick Quance.